ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, I'm giving you a special mini-sode of the podcast, hopefully to get you through until next week. But this episode, you will be hearing my exclusive interview with author William V. Madison, who has written a fantastic biography on actress, comedian, stage star Madeline Kahn, called Madeline Kahn, Being the Music, A Life. So give a listen to my interview with author William V. Madison.
I spent this morning not only caffeinating, but also listening to your Olivia de Havilland tribute.
Oh, thank you.
And the show is very professionally put together. My God, my hat is off.
Thank you so much. I reviewed the hardcover back in October. Yes. I was so excited when they said that you were doing interviews for the paperback. The first question is, can you describe the first time you saw Madeline Kahn on screen?
I am not sure which was the very first. It is entirely possible the very first was from the mixed-up files of Mrs. Basil Lee Frankweiler. It was a novel I loved. The movie came out at the right time. I was exactly the right age. We were all furious because the boy and the girl who play the leads were just not what we wanted them to be. Because, of course, we wanted to be those kids. Hiding out at the Metropolitan Museum of Art is, of course, what we wanted to be doing. Madeline has a two-minute cameo. She plays a school teacher who is so harried she doesn't even realize that two of the kids in her group are not actually her students. And because she was a student teacher herself earlier in her career, she was playing as close to home as she could possibly get, and the museum was 10 blocks from her apartment. So that was great. The other possibility is Young Frankenstein, which was the first grown-up movie my parents let me see on my own. I felt so mature. I realize now they had no idea that the movie gets quite raunchy. But, you know, they let me go, and it was dark outside when I got out of the movie. It was very exciting. And certainly she made a huge impression on me with that. I was already an opera fan, so I actually knew A Sweet Mystery of Life before I heard Madeline sing it. I had a Beverly Sills recording of that song. You know, it's somewhere between those two. The first time I saw it.
Which are two of probably the most at-odds movies. because when you described the movie, and I haven't seen Mixed Up Files of this Basil Frankweiler yet, but describing, hearing and reading the plot and knowing that there's a movie, I was kind of like, isn't that just the perfect sum up of the 70s? Kids just wanted to go hang out in a museum. You could drop in on like a school group at any point. Nobody really noticed. You know, you can't do any of that now.
If you haven't read the novel by Yael Konigsberg, who was a very great woman, I had the pleasure of meeting her once at an author appearance, won the Newbery Award, and it's extraordinary. Brother and sister decide to run away from home, and then they live in the art museum.
I feel so bad. It's one of those, because I was always the weird kid that read all the book lists, because I like to read, and that was always on the list. And I just never got to it. And I don't really have a good excuse why.
There's no time like the present. I will
tell you,
it's one of the most ingenious things. It's been turned into a movie twice. Once with Ingrid Bergman. That's Madeline's version. This is again with Lauren Bacall, whose birthday, for your listeners, is
today.
When we are talking, yes. The story is so ingenious that the Metropolitan Museum of Art has had to change its security standards every time. Once for the book, second for the second movie, the first movie, and three times for the third movie, because kids would actually try it, and you could do it.
It's shocking to believe that Troma put that out, because you wouldn't exactly think that the studio that did Toxic Avenger would also be associated with a classy movie like that.
Was it really Troma?
Yeah.
I know it was a small-time New York operation, and certainly Ingrid Bergman's wig will give you horror. But I did not know it was Troma.
Yeah. I was very shocked when I read that. I actually had to double-click it and be like, wait, are we talking the same Troma? And yes.
Troma was in existence in 1973.
How did all of that translate into you wanting to write a book about her?
Well, it set me off on a very good path, because I understood immediately that I would enjoy Madeline's company became very important because, you know, I picked this project and I started working on it, little realizing that I would spend 7 years putting this book together. I didn't know I was going to be spending quite so much time with Madeline, but I knew she would be good company.
What was there anything that you definitely wanted to set out and achieve? I think too often she's only known for Clue or Young Frankenstein. And in reading the book, I had no information about her personal life. I didn't know that she did television shows. You know, she worked with Bill Cosby. She did all these other things. Was there anything that you said from the get-go, I want people to know this?
Well, there was, absolutely. I think you're right. People who know her generally know her from what I call the Big Five, which are her first two movies with Peter Bogdanovich and her first two movies with Mel Brooks and then Clue. I wanted to understand her relationship with music. That almost instantly became my goal as I began working on the project. I actually came up with the idea while I was watching YouTube clips and struck by what a wonderful singer she was. And when I began speaking with her family, I began to get a glimpse of how important music was to her personally. As a critical person, I understood that she treated a script like a score. And if you watch her performances closely, she's singing the whole time she's talking. And I find that absolutely fascinating. When you couple that with, I've now confirmed, I mean, she was essentially a method actress, which is almost unheard of in that kind of comedy. But that's where you get some of the little moments that make her characters spring into three dimensions. My favorite one of those is in Blazing Saddles. After Lily von Stuck has had this rapturous night of love with the sheriff, he goes on his way and she shuts the door behind him and she leans against the door and she says, "What a nice guy." And you realize she hasn't known a nice guy before. And that's what Madeline brings to it. But generally, even when she's not singing, she is approaching any script as if it were a piece of music. In Blazing Saddles, her big scene is a song.
We don't praise actresses enough for being intelligent in their acting. You know, she played so many kind of ditzy characters, and it, for me, you know, reading the book, it was shocking that, you know, she had a degree in speech. You know, she went to Hofstra, and she was incredibly intelligent, and I think that a lot of people didn't give her credit for the fact that she had very much almost to throw out one of the more, you know, bigger names, almost like a Marilyn Monroe, who, you know, spent a lot of her time educating herself and reading in her off time, and yet never really got that credibility for actually having a brain.
I think there is a similarity to Marilyn, several similarities. Madeline obviously had a head start on education. You know, she was highly cultivated, and Marilyn had to do that single-handedly. They were typecast as sexpots. They both were very vulnerable people, you know, wounded, I think, more dramatically in Marilyn's case than in Madeline's. That's not a bad comparison. And it was very hard for them to get taken seriously. I think Marilyn had better luck certainly becoming a leading lady and also in getting parts in which she was able to show more of her range. Madeline had a hard time with that her entire career, beginning when she was in college, cast as the saucy wench when she was 19 years old.
Oh, and it's very funny, you know, you look at the role that I love Madeline Kahn for is Paper Moon. That's one of my, Paper Moon's one of my favorite movies of all time. And I think that her performance there is, she is a gold digger and an opportunist, but she's aware of that. And she has that moment with Tatum O'Neill's character where, you know, she pretty much confesses that she doesn't really have a whole lot going for her. And there's that self-awareness to her performance that I think does not get the credit, because I think if somebody who was a lesser performer said those lines, it would have just sounded fake. And it sounds very genuine when she does that.
Well, speaking of credit, I should intervene. Peter Bogdanovich has confirmed to me that he did very little work with Madeline on her acting. What he didn't know at the time was that she coached that part to a fairly well with her boyfriend, Michael Carm, who is today a teacher with the Actors Studio in L.A. The two of them had met at a couple of parties and things, but it wasn't until we had an event in Los Angeles back in February that I had the two of them together and we could sort of clear this up. Which, you know, Peter said it was a mystery to me how Madeline came up with what she was doing. She was so natural. And I knew that she had coached with Michael extensively. She also coached with another friend named Larry Moss. I asked Michael if he saw the work that he and Madeline had done together when he watched the movie. He said, absolutely. Everything we did was up there on that screen.
You never met Madeline personally. You said you had appointment books, and that's kind of what you were going with. Was that kind of...
In the appointment books, I saw that we came unbelievably close to meeting multiple times.
Really?
Yes.
That is amazing. Amazingly ironic. And very, very bittersweet.
She has come to me in my dreams, so we're making up for lost time.
Was that difficult for you? I mean, I know most biographers would say that, you know, oftentimes they're coming into this with very little information other than kind of a personal interest. But was that difficult with only those to go off of? What was the research process like?
It was not difficult in that it became clear pretty early on that she and I were simpatici. It was very helpful to me that I had so many of her friends, her family, and her colleagues who wanted to share their stories with me. And the more they talked, the more rounded the portrait became. I got a clearer and clearer sense of who she was. And beyond the family and John Hansberry, the man she married at the end of her life, I would say two friends who were extraordinarily helpful because they were basically on 24-hour calls for 7 years were her friends Walter Willison, who was a castmate of hers in 2x2 with Danny Kaye, and Betty Averlin, who was with her in a nightclub review at the upstairs at the Downstairs Club. Betty Averlin is very well known to watchers of children's television because she was Lady Averlin on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Oh, okay.
Boy, was I excited when I found out that connection because I was a huge Mr. Rogers fan into college, I admit it. But the two of them, anytime there was something I had trouble understanding or I had an idea I wanted to bounce off of them, Betty and Madeline met in 1965 and Walter met Madeline in 1970. So these were two people who had known Madeline throughout her life. And together, they made it much easier for me to understand who Madeline was, along with, as I say, input from her brother. Their relationship was extraordinarily close. Because of the mother, you know, they sort of became allies early on.
Well, I was going to say she was very, very, as you explain in the book, there was a guardedness to her, you know, with her family background and particularly her illness at the end, very much reserved in terms of keeping things to herself. What was that like, breaking that wall down and getting to know the woman as opposed to the actress?
One thing that gave me some trepidation at the very beginning was to see how very little written record there was. She did not keep a diary. She did have one spiral notebook, which she kept for 20 years, in which she would jot down feelings and thoughts and such, which is sort of like a diary, except, of course, the word diary comes from the same root as the word day. She did not keep this thing day by day. And the fact that there's only one really struck me because I have hundreds of those. So she was very meticulous and, you know, very organized. But there was no written record. So how do I capture her voice? That was very important to me. She was a singer. She was an actor. Her voice was how she made her living. But it's also an expression of who she was. And it was important to me also, you know, to get the voices of the people she worked with and the people she knew well. My editor kept telling me to cut down the quotations. And I said, no, you don't understand what I'm trying for here. Why three sentences when two words would do? And I want the reader to hear. There were certain challenges that I had to overcome. And it takes a village to put a book together. And mercifully, the village that I became a resident of was peopled with extraordinary friends who deeply cared about Madeline, who urgently wanted to share their stories.
Once the book was finished, because there was so little written, was there anything that you wanted an answer to that you just there was no proper explanation for it at the end of the day.
Interesting.
I call myself a makeshift biographer. That would imply that I've actually written something down, but I haven't. I've just talked to a lot of people. But one of the people I interviewed said, you're going to come to a point where you're not going to get an answer to something that you want to know, because the person that, you know, Veronica Lake's no longer around, that the only person that knows is her. So was there ever a point where you just said, the only person that's got to know is her, and I'm not going to be able to answer that?
Well, there are small questions, absolutely. The very few written records are basically the contents of her desk at the time of her death. She had some drawers, and there was some correspondence in there, and I went through those boxes. These things include a fan letter from Carol Burnett that led to her being on the show, which was extraordinary, and I think that says a lot about Carol Burnett and why she is so wonderful, is that, you know, she enjoys these old movies, and she enjoys other performers, and she's a fan. And that's what makes her work so good, so rich. In that box was also one of the most extraordinary love letters I have ever read in my life. Passionate paeans to Madeline's breasts, and it was incredible. And it was definitely not written by her husband. it dated from, I'm not sure, the 70s or 80s. It was signed simply Bop, B-O-P. I never found out who Bop was. Nobody knew.
The great unexplained mystery.
There are small questions like that, but obviously she found it an impressive letter too, because she kept it. He meant something to her, or, as I say, it was an extraordinarily passionate letter, and so she kept it because, hey.
Good writing.
Yeah, exactly. It pleased her aesthetically.
We recently lost Gene Wilder, and him and Madeline's work together is some of the best out there. And, you know, what was it like researching their relationship on screen and their friendship off?
Well, it's interesting to me because I think they stand out in a lot of people's minds as one of the great movie couples. And the reality is that they made three movies together. In Blazing Saddles, they are on screen together for a split second. They do not have a scene together. In Young Frankenstein, Madeline's entire part adds up to about 5 minutes. The only movie in which they have a lot of screen time together is The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother. It is one that I recommend very urgently to people who want to understand the range that Madeline had. Gene wrote the movie for her, and it's a love letter, basically, because it gives her a chance to show off all the things that she can do. She sings, she plays comedy, she plays romance, she plays drama. As Gene put it, sometimes all at once. Their relationship was very close in many ways. For a legendary screen couple, they didn't make a lot of movies. Gene was a very interesting person to work with for me, because when we first got in contact, something he said led me to believe that he would sit down with me for a face-to-face interview. So I followed up with that, and the response just jumped out of my computer. I do not want to meet face-to-face. And I knew he was one of the few people I had to have. You know, without him, this book would not be Madeline's story. So I said, you know, listen, any way you want to proceed is fine with me. If it's smoke signals, I don't care. If it's semaphore. Well, we corresponded by email. I quickly understood that when Gene Wilder played the fox in The Little Prince, he was typecast. He was a shy man, and he was not to be tamed. And he wound up being wonderful. Ask him a question, and I would get an answer within an hour. At one point, after the book was in production, you know, he wrote a blurb for the back cover. And I wrote to thank him, and I didn't hear back. And then his birthday came up, June 11th, and I wrote to wish him a happy birthday and to tell him the book was going very well and, you know, thanking him again for all of his help. Didn't get an answer. Well, now we know that his decline had begun. But at the time, I was worried. I thought, you know, gosh, what's going on? And now that I know, you know, our odd relationship is all the more special to me.
You know, him and Mel Brooks, I think, are kind of the last gasp of old comedy that, at least, that most people that I know, and I'm a child of the 90s, so I'm far removed from those films myself, but, you know, they're the last kind of gasp of the comedy from that time period that, I don't know if you've heard, there's talk of remaking Clue. And obviously so much of that film is best remembered for the ensemble cast, but also Madeline's improvised, you know, flames scene and all of that. How do you feel about remaking the film? And do you think we'll ever see someone of Madeline's caliber again?
I think it's symptomatic of what's wrong with Hollywood today. You know, you don't see one movie without seeing four sequels. Everything is a franchise. Why not just remake The African Queen while we're about it?
Oh, give them time, give them time. Is there anybody, you know, working today that you kind of get a Madeline-esque vibe from? And whether it's on the stage or television or movies, is there anybody that maybe has a little bit of that Madeline spark within them?
There are a few people. The first person most people think of, obviously, is Kristen Chenoweth. Kristen has a very different edge to what she does. She is not typically as vulnerable as Madeline was. But, you know, they're both teeny tiny women who sing coloratura soprano. So, and Kristen has done a few roles that Madeline did. But I see in young performers an active opera goer, and I know a lot of young singers. I work also with a small theater troupe here in New York. And there is a generation coming up that studied Madeline. And there are sparks of her. The people who admire Madeline the most, I find again and again, are other performers. And that extends to, you know, Kelly O'Hara, the Broadway star. It extends to some of my young friends, the opera singers. There's a mezzo named Megan Marino, who even looks kind of like Madeline. It's extraordinary. When I started the book, I was realizing that when I entered Madeline's world, I was in junior high school, the people she was working with were all the Young Turks. And now, as you say, they're already gone or they're going. Gilda Radner, long since, but my God, we loved her. We loved Madeline. We loved all the... Mel Brooks was breaking all the rules. It was unheard of what he was doing. And he was using old movies to do it. It was this iconoclasm and symbolic of the times, really, because, you know, we've been let down by Vietnam. We've been let down by Richard Nixon. And, you know, nothing was sacred anymore. So here are these movies and these incredible young Turks who are making these movies. John Belushi, they're all gone. The fact that Madeline's legacy is being carried forward today, the fact that she has a legacy, is extraordinary. Most actors do not have a legacy. Some of the great Hollywood legends, Brando obviously had more legacy than anybody knew what to do with. As a percentage, those who have a legacy are very, very few.
I think it's like 1% or 2% of celebrity out there.
Yeah, and the other thing is that some people with a legacy, you know, that legacy is virtually impossible to replicate. Betty Davis, you can impersonate Betty Davis, but can you be Betty Davis? I don't know that that's true. I mean, we'll see what Susan Sarandon does with the part. You look at the actors whom Betty Davis herself admired among the younger generation, and Jodie Foster is the closest you get.
I would also say that Madeline Kahn is one of those actors, Betty Davis is a great example, who, you know, had that wonderful 30, 40-year career in the last 10, is kind of what a lot of people call the funny movies, because they were just very much parodic. Put her in there essentially because we need somebody with some clout, but they weren't the best movies. You know, something like The Nanny is what I'm thinking of. But Madeline didn't necessarily have that kind of nadir in her career, you know, even though the stuff that she was making wasn't big box office or had huge Nielsen ratings.
She didn't live long enough to be typecast
very
the next
true.
Way, but it was coming. And she would be horrified by this, but it was basically Eunice Burns, her character from What's Up, Doc, whom she hated, who drove her into therapy because she had always played the pretty girl before, and now she was the frump who doesn't get the guy. But starting with Mixed Nuts, the Nora Ephron movie, Madeline was a middle-aged sexless prig, just as Eunice had been a young sexless prig. In the show Cosby, which she was working on at the time of her death, there was a tendency in the writer's room to view her character that way. I think it may have been coming, and in that sense, she's probably very happy right now that she missed out on that. Bill Cosby himself told me that he hated what the writers were doing with her character, and that he tried again and again to get them to come up with a better way to approach the character. But it was easier to do what they did with her. Ask yourself why Bill Cosby, who was the executive producer of the show, couldn't get his writers to do what he wanted. But that's another story. But yeah, I think it may have been coming. There were many glimpses that she was also going to strike out in a different direction. And people who like Madeline and don't know her work exhaustively, the two movies that I recommend most highly are The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother with Gene Wilder and Marty Feldman and Dom DeLuise, her dear, dear friends. And the other is the last movie she made. It was an independent feature called Judy Berlin. And she is extraordinary in it. It is the first part she had in a movie that was not primarily comedic.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of elements of comedy in it. It is heartbreaking. It is intimate. It is detailed. And it was an independent feature. Suddenly she was working on a movie where there was no dressing room. There was no trailer. There were not craft services. It was freezing cold, and there was not hot soup for the actors. Barbara Barry, her co-star, remembered that very vividly. The crew were amateurs. The producer had never made a movie before. And she delivered her finest performance. And it was a middle-aged housewife, but not anything like the other women that she was playing at that point in her life.
We'll never get the answer to this question properly, but how do you hope, or how do you think, based on all the research that you've done on her, that Madeline would receive the concept of somebody writing a book about her life?
She would have been horrified and would have done everything she could to stop me if she were alive. And the reason for that, I think, primarily is that she would not want to embarrass her mother. We now understand that her mother was mentally ill. Madeline didn't really even begin to come to terms with that until she was near death. Certainly in my dreams, she's very happy that I've done this. That is, in fact, something she said to me in one of my dreams. If you believe that sort of thing, there you go. I have an endorsement.
I'll take it.
I think she would not want to be forgotten. She worked very hard. She worked constantly. One of the reasons she worked constantly was that her mother spent money like it was water. And she had to support her mother. Nobody else was going to do that. But she would not want to be forgotten. I think she would be overwhelmed to know how much people still care about her. And that includes the people she actually knew. I mean, the fact that I have been able to put together these events in New York and Los Angeles where people just absolutely agreed to come out. You know, not only did they talk to me for the book, but they agreed to come out to promote the book is extraordinary. Beyond the people she actually knew, the outpouring of love from the fans would overwhelm her. When she died, I remember vividly the day. I was working at ABC News in those days. And the news came in that she had died, and for the rest of the day, all over New York City, people were going around going, "Oh, I loved her so much." And you didn't have to ask who they were talking about. You lost somebody.
It's very funny you bring that up, because I remember, and I don't know why I would remember this, because I was rather young. I remember seeing breaking news when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
The name sounded familiar, and I don't understand why it would sound familiar, because I don't believe, mm-hmm. other than maybe Clue, but it was something that I distinctly remember, which is mm-hmm. amazing that, you know, I think that her legacy is such that, you know, even people that weren't aware of who she was, I think she had one of those faces, so to say, you know, that just you notice it.
Well, and the voice. I asked the people closest to her whether she was aware how much people loved her. Would she have been surprised to know that we took her loss personally? And they agreed she had no idea. That was just not the way her mind worked.
The last question I'll throw out is, and on a fun note, if you had to pick a favorite Madeline performance, do you have one? Is it even possible to pick one?
It's hard. You know, ultimately, it's probably Judy Berlin, but you come right after that and you say the Sisters Rosenzweig, which, if you're a qualified researcher, you can watch the videotape at the Lincoln Center Library in New York. There's Jenny Hill in Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother. But then how can you set aside the Lily von Stupp or Trixie Delight or Eunice Burns? Yeah, she was a remarkable performer. I don't know that I can pick one favorite.
Paper Moon and Clue, I think, are kind of the two that, maybe because I grew up with the latter and I love the former as a more informed film goer. Those are the two that I always throw out there when people ask. They're such great encapsulations of how intelligent her comedy was. We don't get a lot of intelligent female comedians anymore.
Well, and one of the extraordinary things about her is that she is able to convey the intelligence, playing characters who very often are not bright at all. I mean, that was something that came up when she did Born Yesterday on Broadway. The New Yorker critic said this is her specialty, is finding the inner life and the native intelligence to bimbo characters.
It's funny that you bring up Born Yesterday, because I think that there's very much of a Judy Holliday, if memory serves, and you could tell me if I'm totally wrong on this, but it seems almost like they were hoping that she was going to have that Judy Holliday type of characterization, playing kind of the squeaky voice and the characterization that was very similar to how Judy Holliday acted.
A few actors to whom she was compared fairly often, Carol Lombard another, and in both cases, there were opportunities for Madeline to play roles that were in one way or another associated with those actors. Billie Holiday, Madeline actually started in that direction in a very early TV series, really the only time she ever guest starred on a sitcom. It was an adaptation of Adam's Rib, starring Blythe Danner in the Katharine Hepburn part. Blythe Danner had completely forgotten about this, but I asked her about it. But in the pilot, Madeline takes the Billie Holiday part. I sensed that she was uncomfortable with being slotted as the next Billie Holiday or the next Carol Lombard, but there was certainly that quality. I will also say that Garson Kanin, who wrote Born Yesterday and directed the first production with Judy Holliday, was still around when Madeline took the role on Broadway, and he preferred Madeline's interpretation to Billie Holiday's. He found her sexier and tougher.
It's almost ironic because Madeline and Judy Holliday both died relatively young of cancer, and it's frightening.
Well, and the 6 degrees of separation, I mean, I keep finding, you know, I can connect Madeline to almost anybody, and it's driving people crazy in my dinner conversation.
I was going to say that's the new dinner table game I'm going to start throwing out to people.
Yeah. Forget Kevin Bacon. Let's see if you can connect to Madeline Kahn.
Exactly.
But, I mean, there are little themes and narrative arcs within Madeline's story that are very interesting.
I definitely want people to read the book. Somebody who did not know much of anything other than the film.
Well, thank you very much. I wanted to write something that was worthy of her.
I'd say you succeeded.
Well, thank you. That meant a few things. That meant focusing on the work, because that would have been important to her. It meant not turning her mother into the monster or the star of the story. You know, this was Madeline's life. It was not her mother's life. I did my best. But I also wanted to be fair to her mother, who did actually try to butter me up so she would get a better report in the book. She flirted with me, actually, when we met. And I thought, okay, I understand you so well now. Ultimately, the goal was to write something that was worthy of her. She was a very special woman. I wanted to be fair to her. And it wouldn't have been possible to write something salacious, I think. There wasn't that much salacity, if that's a word. It is now. She was a remarkable artist. She took her work very seriously. The work was the one constant thing in her life. And she pursued it with tremendous integrity. And I hope I have reflected that in the book.
And William, just so my listeners, if they want to get in touch or learn more, where's the best place to find out more about the book and about you? And
well, there are a few places, but I think probably the first place to look is on Facebook. There is a page dedicated to the book, Madeline Kahn, Being the Music, A Life. And among the things we do, I also wanted to keep things upbeat. So we celebrate the birthdays of people who played a part in her career. And also news of the paperback. So those are places to begin. There's also a blog for the book. And my own blog is called Beauvisier, which is a French word meaning nonsense that just by coincidence has my name in the first syllable, which is at domaddison.blogspot.com. I don't keep it up as often as I used to, but there's a lot of stuff. If you want to hear about how I spent a week with Fidel Castro, you'll find it there.
Wanted to thank you so much for agreeing
to
chat with me.
This was fun.
If you'd like to learn more about William V. Madison and his biography on Madeline Kahn, I'll be including all the pertinent information in the show notes. You can also look the book up on Amazon or wherever books are sold. I'd like to thank William again so much for being on the show. It was such fun to talk to him. And that's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please feel free to leave a rating and review. That certainly helps the show gain some more exposure. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also now on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Next time, we will be starting our 2-episode tribute to Halloween. So things are going to be getting spooky around here. Until next time.